Okay, so we're in the fourth week of our consideration of the authority of Jesus. And so Mark chapter 4 is sort of a happy coincidence. We're looking at the authority of Jesus, that is his power over all things, his power to rule. He has authority. That's a dominant idea in the Gospel of Mark. And so we're spending 5 weeks on it, and this is the fourth. And we are starting in Mark chapter 4, and here's the starting line. Life gets hard at times. That's the starting point. And I would guess that some of you would say, if you were given to spontaneous outbursts, tell me about it. Because some of you know that life gets hard at times because your life right now is hard. And perhaps some of you would take a moment to say that if you were the sort, because life isn't hard right now, but it sure was a while ago, and you perhaps have just emerged from a hard time. And some of you perhaps are worried about the future and anticipating a hard time. You see a hard time coming, and you know that life gets hard at times. And there's a possibility that some of you have never yet had a hard time and believe that only hard times, some people go through hard times. And, well, it's not true. Life gets hard at times for everybody, one way or the other. At times, life gets hard. And I have good news for you today as we consider the authority of Jesus. There is good news, but you need to know it's good news that comes on condition. And you don't need to keep track of the conditions because the formula we will follow is to get started, which has already happened, and I'll make some observations or some notes on the story as we go, and then there are three actions or three applications. They are the three conditions upon which the authority of Jesus is good news to people in regard to hard times. So let's get started at verse 35. Mark chapter 4, verse 35, "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.'" Now what day? A day in which Jesus had been engaged in a teaching work with a great crowd, a very large crowd, we are told, heard parables all day long. This was, as it turns out, very tiring for Jesus. To teach large crowds in the open air over a whole long day rendered him very tired, or so it seemed from the story. We can guess that everyone was tired, and Jesus says at the end of this long, tiring day, "Let's go to the other side." He would mean the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And what you need to know about the Sea of Galilee is that it's 13 miles from top to bottom, from north to south on a map, and it's 7 miles wide from side to side, from east to west or vice versa. It's 7 miles wide. So he's saying, "It's been a long day, I'm tired, you're tired, everyone's tired, let's go for a 7-mile boat ride in the dark." That's the start of the story. And the notes begins from what happens next, verse 36. "And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling." Let's look at the component parts of that statement. Notice, this is, I think, in ways the most significant little detail, but the one you're most likely to pass over, the four words, "just as he was." They took him, the disciples took Jesus with them in the boat, just as he was. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that he was in his teaching outfit, and they don't usually let people in teaching outfits into the boat, but they took him just as he was? Is it a dress code thing? I wouldn't think so. Is it that he was doing object lessons, so he had been talking about soil, and he had his hands very dirty, and usually they make people wash their hands before they get in the boat so they don't get, you know, the rigging dirty, but they took him just as he was? Was it a hygiene thing? I can't imagine. I think what we have to understand is what the whole of the gospel account is about. It's about the real Jesus. And they took him as he was. They took the real Jesus with all that they knew about him, with all that they knew him to be, with all that they knew in terms of what he thought he was, with all that he was, all of his loves, all of his hatreds, all of his heart. They took him just as he was. And other boats were with him. Now, that's interesting. Maybe just because they saw that he was going across the sea, a whole bunch of people got into their boats and went across with him. So there's this flotilla of boats. There was one boat that was different than the others. It's the boat in which he was. It's the boat that had him in it. And why was that? Well, they had the opportunity to have him in it, and they were willing to take him just as he was. So there's this one boat with the real Jesus, and good that it was for those people, because guess what happens next? Well, you know what happens next. A great windstorm arose. And it got to be very great. The waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. And here's something else to know about the Sea of Galilee. It's not only 13 miles long and 7 miles wide, but it's 700 feet below sea level. And up at the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, to this day, there's an old volcano with two heads, two peaks, called the Horns of Hattin. Now, that's interesting to a military history kind of people because there was a famous crusader battle in 1187, a Battle of Hattin. It was fought in the little gap between those two big horns. But the point about the horns that's of interest to us is that the Sea of Galilee being so close to the Mediterranean Sea, which of course is a really big sea, so it has all kinds of waters, the Horns of Hattin form like a wind funnel, and so it's not at all unusual for the Sea of Galilee to this day to go from perfectly calm to a huge storm because the winds are channeled by the Horns of Hattin through the gap down in 700 feet down. Like the depth of the lake is also a part of it. The winds descend down, and then the lake is like a teapot, a tempest in a teapot, like a storm, like a big, big, violent storm. And the waves are breaking into this boat, so the boat was already filling. That's the position we see them in. That's the hard time we see them in. Here's note number one. There was a time when the disciples were in great danger, and it was Jesus who got them there. Let's think about that. The only reason they were in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the lake, in the middle of a storm, was that Jesus got them there. Jesus was the one who said, verse 35, let's go across to the other side. So this is not at all a random occurrence. This is a deliberate plan of Jesus to put his people into a hard time. Well, let's not think that the weather was a surprise to him. Let's not see that this was just, you know, bad planning on his part. But this was planning on his part. But this is a story about his authority. This is the gospel about his authority, about how he's entirely in charge of all things. And we've seen already in the last 3 weeks how totally in control he is of all circumstances. So it just wouldn't fit the text at all, wouldn't fit the book at all if we suddenly turn this story into this kind of weird thing about how even Jesus makes bad calls sometimes. How embarrassing it must have been for him. Not that at all. We got to see that when the storm was at its most dangerous, there was a time when the disciples were in great danger, and it was Jesus who got them there. This is a story about his authority. It's also a story about the difference made by his presence. There's only one boat that had Jesus in it. All of them were in the middle of the lake in a storm, but only one boat had Jesus in it. And here's note number two. When the storm was at its most dangerous, Jesus didn't seem to be noticing. That's what we get from verse 38. He didn't seem to be aware that they were in great danger because he was in the stern asleep on the cushion. Asleep on the cushion. He wasn't, you know, just like a passenger on a bus who just dozed off a little bit. He was sacked out. There was a cushion. There was like a mat to sleep on in the stern of the boat. And Jesus was asleep on it. He was tired. He had been teaching all day long. I'm sure he was tired from that. But in response to his tiredness, and for other reasons than the fact that he was tired, he took this opportunity to go fast asleep so that it seemed to all the world, to these disciples, that having Jesus in the boat didn't make any difference. He didn't even seem to notice. Everybody was at sea. Only one boat had Jesus in it. It wasn't making any difference at all. So here's what we should be thinking. Life gets hard at times. There are storms. There are dangerous spells. There are times when your life is threatened. And it's a good thing to know that you've made your peace with God, that you've got an allegiance with Jesus. He's in your life. He's in your boat. So brace yourself. The story shows us that there will be times when it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to make any difference. Isn't that intriguing? You know about that at all? I started by saying that some of you don't need to be told that life gets hard at times because you are in a hard time right now. Maybe that's true. So then the question would be, is Jesus in the boat with you? And the extra question would be, is it making a difference? It's one thing for us to say, you know, a right relationship to God does not exempt us from hard times. Christians go through hard times too. But to say, and sometimes it doesn't make any difference that Jesus is with them is really a problem. And yet that's the appearance, and you got to say, because Jesus lay down on the cushion and went to sleep, that it's an appearance that he created. It's an appearance that he wanted to make. He didn't seem to be noticing. And so what did they do? Well, this is verse 38 as well. They woke him. Good thinking. They woke him, and they said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And if any of us are willing to take a stab from our view of human nature, you got to believe they didn't say it like that. Good for them to be polite. They called him teacher, and that is who he is. But they didn't say, do you not care that we are perishing? It's not like, we just thought we'd have a little discussion group in the middle of this storm. So the question is, levels of care and apathy. Do you care that we are perishing? It wasn't like that at all. It couldn't have been like that. I mean, they're in a storm in the Sea of Galilee, famous for its violent storm. So it's like a teacher. Do you not care? They have to yell over the wind, right? Do you not care that we are perishing? And it might have been that they didn't ask the thing politely at all. I mean, maybe it was a question loaded with rude tones. But the significant thing is that they thought to wake him up and ask him about his involvement in their hardship, which brings us to the third note. Jesus didn't seem to help until they asked him to. And this brings us to one of the conditions we're tracking down. You don't need to watch for it. We'll get to it when we get to the actions. But it's worth noting in the story, Jesus didn't seem to help. He seemed to be sacked out. He seemed to be unconscious, sleeping away, until they asked him to. They woke him up and they asked him a question, so they asked him. And we need to notice that because it helps us to understand something about the nature of Jesus. Here it is. He likes to be asked. He wants to be asked. He sets things up so that you don't get any help from him unless you ask. Why would that be? I think I can explain that to you. We'll get to that later. But let's just note for facts. He likes to be asked. And if you were to ask, where did this come from? Like, why is he like that? You could say, he got that from his Father. Because God plainly likes to be asked. The Bible shows us that even in God the Father's relationship to Jesus, there is a liking to be asked. You see that, for example, in Psalm 2, a psalm that gets quoted more than once in the New Testament, a psalm about the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. And Psalm 2:8 says, and this is God the Father speaking to God the Son, to the Messiah, to the coming King, ask of me. God the Father says to Jesus, ask of me, and I'll make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Now you could say, of course God the Father is going to make the nations the heritage of Christ. Of course God the Father is going to make the ends of the earth Christ's possession. That's the reason for which Christ came into the world. But nonetheless, in eternity, from before the foundations of the world, we have God the Father saying, God the Son, go ahead and ask. He likes to be asked. And his Son is just like that. And in relationship to Christ, as Christians, we're in the position where we're supposed to ask because he likes it when we do. I'll leave you to wonder about that for now, just wondering why that would be, but let's just note it. The practical down-to-earth New Testament writer, James, says very plainly in chapter 4, you do not have because you do not ask. We should remember that. Sometimes we're without the help we need. Sometimes we're without the stuff we need. Sometimes we are stuck in the storm, and the storm is seeming to overwhelm us. The boat's filling with water, and no change because we didn't ask. So we should ask. We should remember that. And I should just throw in, so you know that I know, that this is not at all the position some of you are in. Some of you in hard times, or your hard time was so recently that you remember it vibrantly, and you could not be accused of not asking. Some of you would say, I asked, or I'm asking. I never stop asking. I ask and I ask and I ask for God to help me, and nothing is happening. It still seems like he's not noticing. In which case, according to the story, you know, you are in good company. Because that was the position of the apostles. Though notice, for them, when they asked, things began to change. Verse 39, he awoke and he did two things. He rebuked the wind. He rebuked the wind. He looked at this great swirl of moving air, and he told it off. He rebuked it. And he said to the sea, peace, be still. Which is to say, he spoke to the sea with instructions. Now, if all he had said was peace, someone could think that he's saying to the sea, to this great turbulent, frothing quantity of water, you should feel okay about being stormy tonight. Just peace. Be at peace with yourself. Be at peace with your circumstances. But that's not what he meant. The commandment following it makes it clear. He said, peace, like he ordered him. Peace, be still. He gave the Sea of Galilee specific orders. And notice this, the wind that he had rebuked and the sea which he instructed responded immediately. The wind ceased, and there was great calm. Can you imagine that? One moment, It's the most chaotic, horrible scene. These grown men, many of whom perhaps were not good swimmers at all, it hardly mattered. They were 3.5 miles away from shore, were being tossed back and forth and crashing into each other while the wind was screaming in the rigging, if there was rigging, and the mast and all the other parts of the ship were just creaking and threatening to be torn apart by the wind. And then Jesus stands up. Don't picture that as an elegant kind of thing. He's a man in the back of a boat standing up in the middle of the storm. He stands up. He rebukes the wind. He commands the sea, and whoosh, it just stops. And now you got the boat from the momentum of the storm creaking back and forth. Everybody's sort of tipping, getting their balance. And the ship is just coming to still. Totally quiet scene. It's as quiet as the Sea of Galilee can be on a night when there's no wind. Absolutely stunning experience. And we come to note 4. The hard time ended at the moment Jesus told it to. Not a minute before, not a minute late. The hard time ended at the moment that Jesus told it to. And all he had to do to get it to end was to tell it to command the sea, to rebuke the wind. Nothing that needs fixing in that situation couldn't be fixed with a word, and when Jesus gave the word, it was all fixed. Which tells us, in regard to our hard times, there's no detail of your hard time that is such an obstacle to God that he can't fix it. There's nothing that needs fixing that he can't fix. And it's easy. He just has to say it, which comes from the fact that the whole universe exists just because he says it. This we get from Hebrews. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. He holds the whole universe together by the word of his power. The storm only lasted as long as it did by the word of his power, and it ceased as soon as he told it to cease because he upholds all things by the word of his power. Paul, the apostle, says the same thing to the Colossians, but he personalizes it. About Jesus, he says he's before all things. Before is a chronological word. It means he was here first. There didn't used to be anyone but God the Father and Son, the Holy Spirit. He was before all things. And so in him, all things hold together. Everything that exists, exists because he brought it into existence and he keeps it in existence. He holds all things together by the word of his power. Been saying all along, you know, the things that he does and says makes us ask, who does he think he is? And here's the answer. He thinks he's the Lord of all. He thinks he's the master and commander of everything. He is the commander of wind and sea. He's the Lord of every storm. He's the master of all hard times. The wind and the sea was the hard time, and he was totally in control of it. But then let's reflect on the fact that the wind on the sea is not always hard times. For a sailor, if the wind is just right, it's good times. Don't want calm. You want a wind if you're a sailor. He's the commander of the wind and the sea, which means he's the one totally responsible for the hard times and the one totally responsible for the good times. Whether the day on the sea was a delightful day of sailing or a horrendous night of near-death experience, he's the commander. And it goes on as long as he chooses it to go on. Because all things go on as long as he chooses them to go on. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. So there they were in the calm sea. The boat comes to a complete standstill. Now they're stuck in the middle of the lake with 3.5 miles to paddle. At the end of an exhausting emotional experience, at the end of an exhausting day of crowd control, now they've got 3.5 miles to paddle. Questions come to mind. They had a question before, right? We've seen it already in the midst of the storm, verse 38. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? That was their question. And there was an obvious answer to the question. Yes, he cares that they're perishing. And so he calmed the storm so that they'd stop being in such danger. They had a question for him. Now, he had two questions for them. This is verse 40. He said to them, question number one, why are you so afraid? Or why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? That was the first question. Second question, have you still no faith? Have you still no faith? He had two questions. This is note 5. Jesus questioned his disciples about their fear and their faith. Why these two subjects? Well, this is what the story's all about. He had a question to them about their fear because their fear was their alternative to their faith, right? They were terrified because they couldn't trust God to see them through this storm. So he asked them about their fear, because it's the alternative to the right response to hard times, which is faith. And he asked them about their faith, because without faith, they would perish. And his answer to their question was, yes, I do care that you're perishing. So he taught them a lesson about faith, because without faith, we will all perish. If we do not believe, we will all perish. John 3:16, the most familiar verse in the New Testament, perhaps, explains that. This is how God loved the world. He gave his only begotten Son so that certain things would be true. That is, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. Without believing, you will perish. You will perish eternally. So he asked them about their faith, because this is about preventing people he cares about from perishing. Well, at the end of the day, which in fact is the end of the night, the middle of the night, and the end of the storm, the disciples were left with one more question, a question to which they ought to have known the answer. And it's verse 41, the end of the story. Verse 41, they were filled with great fear. That's pretty interesting. The storm's over. They're still terrified. They were filled with great fear, and they said to one another, this is their closing question, who then is this that even the wind and sea obey him? Once again, he did something that raised the question, who does he think he is? Or more fundamentally, who exactly is he? And they had an answer. He's the commander of wind and sea. He's the one that the wind obeys. He's the one that the storms obey. All that turbulent air, all that turbulent water, responsive to his command, because he's their commander. He's the commander of wind and sea. In fact, he's the commander, the master and commander of everything. And this is good news to people in hard times. And this is good news to people anticipating hard times. And people looking back on hard times and wondering what to make of that hard time. What should you make of it? Well, that would depend. Because the fact that the authority of Jesus is good news to those in hard times is conditional. And these three actions coming up, the three applications, are the conditions upon which the authority of Jesus comes out as good times. So here's the first. Have faith in the sovereign kindness of Jesus. That's action A. Got to be a person who actually believes in the sovereign kindness of Jesus. And let me just say that if you are going into a hard time, you will be well served by the fact that before you got to that hard time, you worked this out. One of the great privileges of life for me as the pastor of this church is I have the privilege, the daunting privilege, of talking to people at the moment that their hard times occur. And I got to tell you, from a long time of doing this, I have been so totally convinced of the significant difference it makes to have worked out a correct view of God beforehand. Because when you're in the storm, the details of the hard times are so distracting, so gripping, it's pretty tough to get involved in a thorough investigation about what the Bible says about the sovereign kindness of Jesus. So it's good for you to do your work in between hard times so that when the hard times occur, you know what you believe. You don't have to go looking for what you believe. What you should believe about Jesus is that he is sovereign, that is, totally in control of everything, and willing to use his control in regard to his attitude towards his people, which is an attitude of kindness. It's a matter of believing, despite all the apparent chaos in the world that suggests that the world is totally out of control, that it's not out of control because there is a great king reigning over us, and he is a kind king. He's a compassionate king. There is a king. That's our message. That's the good news. There is a king. What kind of king? Yes, a kind king. He's really kind. He means to do good to us and not harm. He means to pay attention to us and not ignore us because of his kindness. And if you can believe, if you can have faith in this sovereign kindness of Jesus, then you'll be able to do like the Bible people do, who get into really difficult times and get through them with peace and joy. You get to be like David, Psalm 27. He knew about hard times. And he says, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" He has a story to tell, not about winds and seas, but about enemies. He says, "When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it's they who stumble and fall." You could put David together with the disciples and say, well, what do we know about hard times? We know that the winds will cease, the storms will cease, the waters will calm exactly when the sovereign, kind king chooses to have them calm. And our enemies and our assailants and our evildoers will chase us as long as God lets them chase us, and then they'll stumble and fall. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Good question. Whom shall I fear? What am I afraid of, and should I be? The psalm goes on to get to our action, believing in the sovereign kindness of Jesus. It comes out in verse 13 and 14, the conclusion of the psalm. David says, "I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." And so he's able to encourage other people to do it. He says to us, "Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord." David's able to say that because he came to believe not only in the goodness of God in general, in the goodness of the Lord, but believe that he would look upon the goodness of the Lord while he was alive, while he was in the land of the living. This is a person who knows there's nothing to fear if you are believing in Jesus because of his sovereign kindness. Clearly, we don't know what the future holds, but we know who's planning the future. We know that he's kind and totally in control, and we need to believe that. Now, let me just say to those of you who are quite prepared to believe in the sovereign kindness of God and believe that you will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, and all of your circumstances are going to work out according to his plan, and his plan is based on his kindness towards you, let me say to the rookies, brace yourself. Because we're dealing here with someone who doesn't have the same sense of timing as we do. We're dealing with the king to whom a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as a day. So brace yourself to be patient in waiting to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. I'm thinking of what we see in the prophet Jeremiah 600 years or so before Jesus was walking on earth. And here's a little text in the middle of Jeremiah that helps us to brace ourselves. Jeremiah quotes God, "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place." And now we get into familiar territory. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for wholeness and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you." God says, "I know the plans I have for you, plans for wholeness and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." There's a verse crying out to be made into a wall plaque. And maybe you got a wall plaque that says it. But put it in its context. And through the prophet Jeremiah, God is saying, you only have to wait 70 more years. I have plans for you, plans and hope. So take heart. It's only 7 decades until you'll see it. That's pretty mind-boggling. Brace yourself. God is not in a rush. The disciples got to the place where the storm was calmed. But if he had kept it going 5 minutes more, would he have been late? If he kept it going all night long, would he have been overdue? If he'd let them drown at sea, would he have been unkind? We're serving a God who has a very different sense of timing and a much broader sense of purpose. So we need to brace ourselves. And then action B, we've seen this already, but now it comes down as a condition upon which the good news is based. You got to ask for his help. You must ask for his help because he likes to be asked. So now we can answer the question, why? Why does he like to be asked? He got it from his father. Why does God like to be asked? Well, that's because the whole purpose of life is to know God, to be related to God. Do you see that? So the purpose of every experience, like your hard times and the breaks between hard times, has everything to do with the big purpose, which is that there would be a people who would know God. He likes to be asked because by asking God to help, we renew the relationship or we intensify the relationship. We're not like a person who is, you know, 100 miles away from the person who's supplying him with the help and never connects at all. We're sort of like the people who Skype every night, the people who stay in touch. We need to be like that with God. He means to be asked because he means for us to be in a relationship to him. And now I wonder if you can see from your own experience that the hard times have come into your life, not to make a complicated thing simple as if there's only one reason, but can you see that at least one of the reasons why hard times have come into your life is to get you connected better to God, to reconnect you to God, to connect you more intensely? This is about building faith. We can see it back in Jeremiah's day. That great passage goes on to say in verses 13 and 14, God says to these people who are now going to have to wait 70 years before they get their storm calmed, he says to them, "You will seek me and find me." That's God's intention for them. You'll seek me and find me. And then we get a little insight into why it took seven decades. "When you seek me with all your heart, I will be found by you," declares the Lord. And here God in his wisdom is saying in regard to the nation of Israel that had had a problem, like a deep personal problem for a long time. They had a problem with idols. They could hardly resist the temptation of worshiping idols. So they went off down into idol territory. They went down to Babylon and they lived among the idol-worshipping people for long enough to get wholehearted about God so that in their seeking of him, they would seek him with all their heart. For God's agenda for his people is, you will seek me and find me. You will seek me and find me. And then God brings experiences into our life, both, you know, wonderful days of sailing in a brisk breeze and horrible days of being nearly drowned at sea. He works the circumstances to bring details into our lives so that we will learn to seek him with all our hearts. Because it's when we seek him with all our hearts that we will be that he will be found by us. God means to be found. So he asks us to ask. So we got to ask. And perhaps you're that person who says, "Oh, I know that. I've been asking constantly and the storm is still raging. I've been asking constantly and the prayer is not answered." Well, that brings us to condition three. Action C, turn away from fear by staying focused on Jesus. The great key here is to get focused on Jesus and then to stay focused, to believe that you'll see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living and to keep believing that you'll see it, to wait for it, even if it's 70 years. It'll be as long as it takes for God to work his purposes through it. That's good news. There's purposes in the suffering. There's purposes in the hardship. But one of the purposes is to teach us to keep our eyes focused on Jesus so that we can turn away from fear. And fear otherwise will keep us turning away from Jesus. You know, if I had twice the amount of time I have, which I don't, so I won't take it, but if I had twice the amount of time, we'd go from here to chapter 6 of Mark, which is sort of chapter 2 of the story, because this lesson that they learned one night in the middle of the Sea of Galilee was to be advanced by part 2, which was the walking on the water thing that's recorded in Mark chapter 6. And we can leave that alone. You can look at it for yourself because the lessons that walking on the water teaches is this lesson all over again. They learn to walk right over, Peter especially, would learn to walk right over the storm, right over the water by focusing his eyes on Jesus. And when he took his eyes off Jesus, he stopped walking and he started sinking. That's the lesson. And that's the lesson for us in our hardships. God is orchestrating the details of our life. Jesus is continuing the storms in our lives so that we will learn to keep focused on him. And that's what we get in the great passage of Hebrews, which we'll end with. This is Hebrews chapter 12, where our experience as followers of Christ is compared to a long-distance race. And perhaps you know this real well, but think about its application to this aspect of life. The writer says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, since so many people from Bible days could tell us to keep going, let's keep going. Let us also lay aside every weight. Let's lay aside the fears and the doubts and the idolatrous loves. And let's lay aside the sin, which the fears and the doubts and the other loves can so easily lead to us, and they so closely cling to us. Let's lay all that aside, and let's run with endurance the race that's set before us." Here it is, looking to Jesus. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, says another translation. Why should we look to Jesus? Because he's the founder and perfecter of our faith. And our faith is strengthened as we see him as he is. Our faith is perfected as we take him into our boat just as he is. We need to keep our eyes focused on him in order for us to grow strong in faith and to resist the fears that otherwise will swamp us, otherwise will drown us. So, back to the beginning. Life gets hard at times, but you knew that already. Here's the good news. Jesus is well able to end every hardship with a word. And here are the conditions upon which you can expect him to end your hard times and to use your hard times to accomplish his purposes in you and then through you as other people see your peace and your joy in your hard times. Let's pray and ask God to instruct us as we reflect upon these truths. Father, we thank you for your word. Like a lamp in the darkness, like a sword that pierces and divides our hearts, I pray that you'd help us to humble ourselves, to kneel before your truth, and to take upon ourselves the right attitude towards our circumstances and ourselves and you in view of what you show us in your word. You are the calmer of the storm, every storm. You can be the calmer of the storm that we live in just now. And I pray that you'll strengthen us in our convictions that that is the case, that we might go from here to be the people who show the world that indeed you are a great God, great in your sovereignty, great in your kindness. We praise you and pray that you help us to believe it to the glory of Jesus.